Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that believes that unicorns fart glitter. He is the captain.
It's not a belief, it's just science, my friend. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week we are drinking Gold Star Pilsner by the fine, fine people of Lancaster Brewing Company in beautiful, and might I add, well-kept Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Garage grade 3.5 bottle caps out of 5. This is a classic bohemian-style pilsner that brings noble hop flavor and traditional maltiness into perfect union. It's July, it's hot outside, why not drink a beer that is crisp and refreshing? And Gold Star Pilsner was brought to us by these cool cats. First up, we have Michelle and Pickles in Kent, Ohio.
And also a shout out to Rebecca in Columbus, Ohio.
Next up, we have Melissa in Grangeville, Idaho.
And big we like you jib to Truckin' Johnny in Superior, Wisconsin.
Let's give a cheers to Richard in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And a big cheers, mates, to Canadian nurse Barbara. And a cheers to all the nurses.
And last but not least, a shout out to Mike in New Jersey. And thanks to everybody for helping us out with this week's beer fund. If you want to help us out with next week, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And you want to check out truecrimegarage.com right now, go to the store page. We got a couple fancy items for you. We have a beer koozie, finally, and we have a little tumbler, a little beer tumbler, or I guess you could drink some whiskey out of it. And we also have coffee mugs, finally. Finally, after 20 years of being on the air.
All right, that's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime.
It's a cold case, 25 years in the making, and the family of former Rorristown Elementary School teacher Christy Mirak is staying positive on the case. News 11's Holly Hare met with Christy's brother and has more from the emotional day. Holly.
Shannon, emotional is just skimming the surface. You can imagine today is a difficult one to face for the Mirak family, but Christy's brother Vince met with me outside of the apartment where she was killed and is speaking out in hopes that this might bring the case to a close.
It's been a long time since I've been here, and it all looks the same. The trees have gotten bigger, but the building still looks the same, and it's hard. It's really hard. The whole thing right here it's eerie.
It's been years since he stood within sight of his sister's apartment, but the pain of what happened there on this day 25 years ago remains the same.
There's good days and there's bad days, and today's not a good day.
Despite his sorrow, it's Vince's mission to keep Christy's story at the forefront.
And that's my whole point here. I'm here to give, you know, keep her face out there, keep her name out there, keep it alive, that hopefully in somewhere somebody comes out and gives us that bit of information that we need to get this solved.
And he doesn't have to do it alone.
You know, it's hard to believe it's been almost 25 years.
In November, the Lancaster County DA's office sent DNA from the case to Parabon Labs, a company specializing in DNA phenotyping.
The investigators got tips that they're following up on, so hopefully we get some information on this and, you know, move forward.
The results brought the Mirak family new hope for finding Christy's killer.
Hopefully, you know, somebody jogs somebody's memory. Somebody looks like somebody. I mean, it's around the holidays where people are coming back to this area. Maybe somebody recognizes the person.
Patience, persistence, and a brother's unconditional love.
I've never really given up hope.
Good.
Three things keeping the name Christy Mirak in the spotlight. Although still positive, Vince is hoping for a righteous end to this quarter-century-long saga.
That's closure in my eyes. You know, she's never going to come back. We understand that. But as long as we can get someone that paid, you know, serve justice for this, that would be good enough for us at this point.
Today's case takes place in beautiful Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Lancaster County has 6 suburbs located within its borders. East Lampeter Township is one of those suburbs. The township covers 21 square miles and has a population of approximately 16,000 people. East Lampeter is in what they call Amish country. The picturesque landscape has rolling hills and lush green grasses and crops. There are farms with windmills and horse and buggies sharing the roads with Cadillacs and Camrys. East Lampeter Township rate of violent crimes was and is extremely low. Here you have a better chance of colliding with a horse and buggy than getting robbed. This is a perfect combination of a little bit of city living with the landscape and the feel of country living. This most certainly is an ideal place to live, work, and raise a family. Christy Merrick decided this would be the perfect location for a young woman to start her professional life. Christy was lucky enough to find a nice 3-bedroom townhouse and what she saw as a perfect location. This is the Greenfield Estates. Luck struck a second time when she found the perfect roommate to share her townhouse with, as well as the bills. Christy Merrick and her female roommate lived in a quiet development of townhomes located near a business park with a barn and a grain silo just steps away. This place could only be described as peaceful and quiet. If she steered clear of the horse and the buggies, she would be safe. At least that is what she thought. Now, 25-year-old Christy Merrick had wanted to be a school teacher for as long as anyone could remember. Heck, she had practically been rehearsing her whole life for her dream job. When she was little, she would play pretend school, and Christy's brother and sister were her first group of students. And Christy would always end up playing the role of the teacher. At school, Christy was the perfect student. She worked hard and received great grades. Her hard work paid off when she was accepted into Millersville University. Now, she didn't want to burden her parents with the cost of college, so she worked as a part-time waitress at a local country club. She also did some work as an assistant to a pharmacist at the Neffsville Pharmacy. This, of course, to help pay her way. Christy was a very positive person with a beautiful personality. Now, she worked these part-time jobs with the same great attitude that she applied in life.
Uh-huh.
Friends and co-workers would say that Christy was always happy and could easily make her surroundings better than before she had arrived.
Kind of opposite of Captain Grumpy Pants.
Well, I think you're battling through something over there today.
It's either a cocaine addiction or allergies.
The captain is what they would refer to in sports as he's playing, but he's about 75%.
Yeah, maybe 65.
After graduating from Millersville University, Christy set out to make a difference. Her dream came true when she was hired as a sixth grade teacher at Roarstown Elementary School, located in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. She loved her students, and the feeling was mutual. Her enthusiasm was contagious, and she quickly became a favorite not only with her students, but with the parents and other teachers as well. Now, she was living her dream. The pay allowed her to do what 25-year-old women want to do. She liked to have fun, and this included hitting some of the local night spots with her girlfriends. Never to excess, though. She was not that kind of person. She was very concerned about safety as well. A young lady walking around drunk could be dangerous, so Christy knew better. Her father had advised her on ways that she could keep herself safe, and she followed his advice. She would have her keys out and ready
right
when she was ready to leave. You know, she would park in different parking spaces at the townhouses where she lived. She would drive different routes home from time to time, and she would never answer the door without asking several times who was knocking, who's there.
Right.
Little safety tip here, Captain, go with a peephole instead of just shouting through the door.
Yeah.
So these were all practice precautions to keep her safe in her controlled environment. On Sunday, December 20th, 1992, Christy spent the evening preparing gifts for her students. I think this kind of shows what kind of person and what kind of teacher she was. She was giving each child a copy of the book Miracles on Maple Hill. This is by Virginia Sorensen. Inside the front cover, Christy wrote the same message inside each book. And it stated something to the effect of, "Wishing you a very Merry Christmas and a great 1993. Love, Miss Merrick."
You know, like in one of the students, she wrote like, "I hope you're not in my class next year," or something. Like, you know, just one of them.
don't talk to me in 93.
Yeah, 93, we're not on speaking terms anymore.
Well, she tied a little candy cane to each book to add a little Christmas decoration flavor. This being described as very much in typical Christie fashion. After a good night's sleep, Christie was ready for the new week. She woke up, started her day, and got ready to go off to work. Now, I want to kind of bring something up here. Studying this case and looking into this case brought back some memories for me for grade school, middle school. And that week, you know, this is the week before you leave to go on Christmas vacation.
It's one of the best weeks of school.
It's like the period. It's the best school week. You don't really, there's, am I crazy? Or is there like the work is a little less?
The work's a lot less.
It seems a very relaxed. And
this is
kinda
very similar to the week before spring break as well. Same, and the end of the year. So it's like, those are the three best, I think, times to be in elementary school or middle school.
Well, and even if you have a teacher that you disagree with, the teacher's always in a very good mood that week because they know they're going to be off and not have to see you the following week.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And then you're in a good mood too, as well, because you're like, hey, I'm going on break. And when you're a child, Christmas is like waking up in Disney World. So Christie woke up probably very excited for the week ahead, and she got ready to go off to work. Now, Christie's roommate had left for work first on this day and was already gone by the time Christie had put on her brown leather jacket and winter gloves.
Do we know what her roommate did for a living?
I do not know what she did for a living. But the roommate is gone. And at this point, Christie is preparing the gifts. Remember, she has all these gifts to bring to school that day for her students. And she's preparing the gifts to be loaded into her car, placing them near the front door. She grabbed her keys and she started out the door and into the cold Lancaster County air. But just as soon as she felt the rush of cold air, someone had grabbed the door and pushed Christie back inside. The man entered her home, closed the door behind him, and tackled her to the ground. After Christie's roommate had left for work, Christie's attacker was just outside waiting for the sound of the door to open so he could push her in. By 9 a.m., Christie's sixth grade classroom was full with the exception of Christie, the teacher. This was extremely unlike the young, hardworking professional. Rarely was she late to work, and rarely did she ever miss work. Even more strange, Christie had not called into the school's office to say that she would be late or absent that day. So her boss, the principal of the school, this is Harry Goodman, calls Christie's home looking for her. Now, the phone rings, but rather than Christie or her roommate picking up, the phone just rings and rings. At first, Principal Goodman just assumed maybe Christie was not picking up the phone because she had already left.
She's on her way to work.
And was still on her way to the school. But we have to keep in mind here, I have a feeling that even though her class is waiting for her at 9 a.m., that they've been waiting for some time. And maybe Christie had obligations before this 9 a.m. Time when he starts calling for her.
Right.
So he gives it another few minutes and he tries calling Christie again, but receives the same result. Nobody picks up the phone. Goodman opened up Christie's file and retrieved a phone number for Christie's mother. Goodman called Christie's mother and informed her that she had not arrived at school that morning and was asking if Christie had visited Shamokin, I believe that's how you pronounce that. That's where the mother lived that weekend. That is where Christie's parents lived, right?
Right.
So Mrs. Merrick informed the principal that Christie had not visited her in Shamokin that weekend and that the mother started to become very worried at this point.
Yeah. But good for the principal for calling, you know, the emergency contact number.
Yeah. So Mrs. Jerry Merrick is her mother. She started calling Christie's East Lampeter Township townhouse. And just like when the principal had called, her daughter never answered.
Right.
So shortly after 9 a.m., Principal Goodman drives to Christie's townhouse. He arrives at approximately 9:15 a.m. He parked his car and he made his way up the sidewalk to her townhouse. When he gets to the front porch, he notices that the front door is slightly ajar. He lightly pushes with his hand and the door swings all the way open.
This is not a good sign.
No. And inside, Goodman finds Christie's motionless body lying on the living room floor. And the students' gifts are scattered throughout the room. Christy still had her jacket and her gloves on, but her underwear, pants, and shoes had been removed, and the clothing on her torso was pushed up. The police were called and arrived very quickly. Now, Principal Goodman had to call 911 from a neighbor's house, and when he ran out of Christy's townhouse, he closed the door behind him. And when the police arrived on the scene, they found the front door locked, so they were forced to break in to get to Christy.
Okay.
So Christy, unfortunately, was reported dead on police arrival.
Well, it might have been one of those things where you locked the door from the inside, and then she went to leave, and that's when she was attacked, bringing her back into the apartment. And then when the perpetrator left, they didn't shut the door, and the door is still locked.
Yeah.
So that's probably what happened.
Well, detectives begin to scour the scene for clues. Immediately, they noticed that there was no signs of forced entry into the home. Here we have some options as to what may have happened here. And earlier I said that the attacker waited outside, waiting to hear the door open to push her in. Well, that's one option. That's kind of a bit of a creative avenue you have to go down to tell a bit of a story.
Right.
But here we're at the point where we have to wonder how this individual may have got to Christy that morning.
Possibly, you know, she knew the perpetrator.
Exactly. Did she let her attacker in? Was this someone she knew, or was this someone she thought she knew? Maybe mistaken identity.
Right.
Did someone knock and she just opened up the door? Which seems maybe unlikely when we have the brother and her father later saying that she would often call through the door, who's there? You know, who is it? Multiple times to kind of confirm who it may be on the other side of the door.
Well, it's such a weird time for an attack, too. I mean, you know, before 9 a.m. in the morning. I mean,
early on a Monday morning.
Yeah, very, very odd.
Started the work week for most people. And as we said earlier, was this a situation where someone had seen Christy's roommate leaving for work, and then the attacker decides to make a move because of either A, believing that Christy is now alone inside the home, and B, knowing she will go out the front door and walk out to her vehicle? How much did this attacker know about this situation?
Right. But without the force entry, it seems like the perpetrator knew Christy.
Either knew her routine or knew her personally, yes.
Right.
So from what detectives could see, it looked as if she was assaulted almost instantly at the doorway. They found shoe scuff marks on the inside portion of the front door. They found scuffs and scrapes on the entryway floor, suggesting that Christy was dragged from the front entrance way to back inside of the home into that front room.
So she was hit with something?
Well, let's go through this. It appears that she would have been dragged. I don't know if she would have been tackled or hit before the dragging took place. There was a slash in the sofa slipcover.
Uh-huh.
And it was also noted that no furniture was overturned. So this was a scuffle, but it seemed pretty contained to the front door area. So other than the books that were to be gifts,
right,
having been strewn about, there was not a lot of disturbance to the room or to the items inside the home where she lived.
Right, which makes it lean more towards somebody that's physically bigger than her, somebody that could control her pretty easily.
And
less likely somebody her equal size, because you'd think there would have been more of a struggle.
Right. Well, and a wooden cutting board was found near Christy's head. It was covered in blood, and Christy's face was distorted. She had been hit with this several times.
Yeah.
Merrick had suffered a brutal beating as well. And it appeared to detectives that she had fought hard and desperately for her life. A cutting board may sound like an unlikely weapon, but it seems on the surface to be a very unlikely weapon. However, as weird as it sounds, Captain, I've read several cases where a cutting board is used in an attack.
Right.
And I think why, because of several reasons. Okay, this is a heavy object. And usually, not always, but usually these cutting boards are kept on countertops.
So, right, I'm assuming this was Christie's cutting board.
I believe it to be, yes. I don't think that an attacker is bringing a cutting board as choice of weapon to the scene.
That'd be a little strange.
Right.
Why is he walking around with a cutting board?
I feel like you could pick a dozen better weapons.
Yeah, if you ever see somebody walking around with a cutting board, call the cops.
Well, so here's my thoughts on this.
Unless they're coming out of Pottery Barn.
The other cases where I've seen a cutting board used in the perpetration of a murder is, you know, it's readily available to the attacker if it's kept on the countertop. You know, if the attacker came into the scene unprepared or surprised when they could not overtake the person they were attacking, this is something that they might see on the countertop, go for, knowing that they could strike the individual and render them unconscious or knocking them to the ground and maybe kind of gain control of the situation.
I think this is actually latter here, though. I think it's almost like there was an attack that happened and the blunt force trauma would have happened afterwards.
Well,
that's just my gut feeling.
And I also, this kind of, the cutting board being used as a weapon almost is the same reason why you see a kitchen knife often being used as a weapon, because sometimes it's something that's in a knife block sitting on the countertop and it's just something you see in the area that you go and grab and reach for,
right,
during the course of an attack or a scuffle. Now, also, sometimes the person that is being attacked, you know,
will grab something.
Yeah, when they discover someone in their home, they grab whatever for defense, and maybe she grabbed the cutting board and the attacker ends up taking it from them and using it against them.
Right.
Regardless, Christie suffered blunt trauma to her neck, back, upper chest, and her jaw was fractured. Her elbows and knees were very badly bruised. The cause of death was strangulation. After investigating the scene for almost 3 hours, the phone at Christie's home began to ring. An officer picked up the phone. It was Christie's mother, Jerry Merrick.
That's horrible for the mom, you know?
Yeah. Keep in mind, she's still worried because she's not heard from her daughter and she's not heard from Principal Goodman.
But that's the worst case scenario. I mean, you're trying to call your daughter at her apartment. She's young. She's a young professional. She seems very dedicated to her job and to the children she's trying to teach, trying to make the world a better place. And you're calling just to see if she's okay, and then a police officer answers the phone.
She's simply calling to find her daughter, to see if Christie is okay, to get in touch with her. Now, the officer that picked up the phone told her that they needed her, Mrs. Merrick, the mother, to come to Lancaster. Mrs. Merrick asked why, what is wrong?
Right.
Was Christie okay? Was she hurt? Was she involved in, what was going on? And the officer would say no more other than there was an accident and Christie was dead.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go. For a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Like countless crazy tournaments, you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Or timed events, offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. Unique playing pieces and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Cheers, mates. Welcome back to the Colonel and Dick Nose show.
All right, Captain. Let's go through the investigation.
I just sound awful. I sound more awful than I normally do.
You usually sound pretty good. Not today, my friend. Not today. I said 75%. I think you're right, 65%.
I sound like I have a bowl of soup in my nose.
Have another cup of coffee, and maybe we'll get you up in the percentile a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's go through the investigation, because I think most will agree that it looks like the police did a good job with this one. And our murderer, well, he left evidence. He was not super stealthy when committing these crimes. So shall we start with eyewitnesses first or move to the physical evidence?
Well, am I right in saying that it seems like the motive was the rape?
Yes, it seems. I don't know that I would say 100% that the motive was the rape, but it's looking that way. It certainly looks like this is a personal crime.
Right, but we're gonna have evidence. We're gonna have at least evidence of semen on the victim. Okay.
All right. So let's go through eyewitness evidence first, and then we'll get into the physical stuff. So neighbors say that they saw a car pull into a lot directly across from Christie's home. This was shortly after Christie's roommate left for work at approximately 7 a.m. Witnesses described the vehicle as a 1984 to 1991 Dodge Daytona or Turismo hatchback. It was either faded silver, dull gray, or faded white in color.
Okay.
The vehicle's distinguishing features included roll-up headlamps and black sunshades on the back window. Now, a man jumped out from the car, and according to these witnesses, was seen jumping out of the car and heading toward Christie's door. Police would later describe this man as Caucasian, in his 20s, tall with an athletic build, and sandy blonde or light brown hair, possibly in a crew cut. This, of course, according to the eyewitness statements that they gathered when talking to neighbors and canvassing the area.
Okay.
Police theorized at the time that Christie either knew the man or opened the door expecting to see someone else when he then forced his way inside. As we discussed earlier, the possibilities of how did this individual manage to get inside the home or get a hold of Christie, at least. A neighbor heard a single scream at approximately 7:15 a.m. Now, no one claims to have seen this man leave. And I'm guessing, you know, leaving either Christie's home, the front door, front porch area, or even leaving the lot across the way.
Well, and also these townhomes, they're in a row. So there's multiple units. So you could see a man walking towards a unit, but you don't know exactly which unit that he went into. But now that you have a unknown male heading towards those row of townhouses, then we could assume that this guy is probably the one that was the perpetrator in this crime.
Yes. And although police initially proceeded under the assumption that Christie may have known her killer, they also didn't want to rule out the possibility of a random killing. Now, the medical examiner's findings were that Christie had been beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled sometime between 6 and 8 a.m. that morning. Now, remember, the roommate said that she had left the townhouse for work right around 7 a.m.
Okay.
So unless you suspect the roommate was involved in any way.
We got set. Now it makes the window 7 to 8.
Yes, we've narrowed this attack and the murder to a very small window of about 60 minutes.
All right, let's go over the physical evidence.
Well, you were exactly right, my friend. As you had stated earlier, the police did recover and catalog DNA from the murder scene. This was DNA from sperm found on several areas of her body and clothing, and also on a piece of the carpet immediately underneath of her. Now, for the investigation, as for tracking this guy down, for that portion of the investigation, the Merrick family offered up a $10,000 reward for information in the case.
Yeah.
From what I could find in the reports, it looks like initially three men were considered to be suspects by the police. So right away, we have some persons of interest, which we don't see that in every case that we cover. So this is good news if you're, you know.
But again, the law enforcement was leaning towards the fact that she knew,
yes,
you know, her attacker. So therefore, that kind of makes the, you know, we narrowed down the time frame, but we're narrowing down this pool of individuals.
Yes. So three men were considered to be suspects by the police initially, we believe. And this may have actually included Principal Goodman.
Really?
And the thought here is, okay, so, and I want to be clear about this. We know from the reports that they had suspected three individuals, possibility that one of these three individuals had killed Christy Merrick.
We have three douche canoes and a canoe.
I can't say with certainty that law enforcement considered Principal Goodman to be one of these, but what I can say is in the public eye and in the media, it certainly looked like some people suspected he might be one of these possible suspects.
Yeah, and in all fairness, he called people. That's possibly to establish an alibi, but he also found her.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore, that's going to just, create some red flags and some questioning whether or not he was involved at all.
The person who finds the murdered victim should always be looked at as a suspect, right, in my opinion. And furthermore, to that effect, I think the public and the media were questioning why he was so quick to go over to her home.
Right.
And then the other thing was the police show up and all of a sudden the door is locked.
Right.
And you kind of went over the logistics of that possibly it may have been set to be locked before the principal even went into the apartment.
Right.
And then the act of closing the door behind him when he runs over to get a phone to call 911, I actually find that to be an honorable act on two levels. One, if I'm a detective, I'm like, cool, this dude helped preserve the crime scene in a small manner by closing right. the door. And furthermore, it's, the way that her body was left,
right.
It's not something that, she was left in a way that was degrading to her. And for him to close the door, to have the forethought to close the door as a sign of respect to his colleague, I think was a simple, nice gesture.
Well, and what a mensch of a guy, because he's at work, he's a principal, and she's young. She has a roommate, but she lives with another female, and he probably felt protective of her on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you call at 9 o'clock, and then by 9:15, he could have just had a gut feeling that something's not right. And I just think what a guy for going over and caring about his employees.
Well, and not only that, time of death was believed to be between 6 and 8 a.m. And as we've discussed several times on this show, specifically when we discussed the Aurora Hammer Slayer case, it's not just so easy that, like you see on TV where they walk up, they stick something in the body, they take its temperature, and they go, well, the time of death was 7:13.
Right.
They are going off of body temperature. They're using other determining factors to come up with that time frame. However, a lot of times, and what we see here is what we can infer when we look at these cases, is sometimes these individuals are supposed to, meaning the victim, were supposed to have been somewhere or been with someone
right.
at a certain time. And when they do not arrive at that location or they do not meet that person, well, we can assume that they were either in danger or already dead by that time. So here's my guess. When they say 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., is there a chance that she was supposed to be at school around 8 a.m.? And because she was not seen at that time, then, okay, she may have already been in trouble or she was already murdered by that point.
Yeah, because some teachers have like early morning duties. They can sign up for that. I think they get paid a little extra. Not really for sure, but where you will get there, why the buses get there. So you have to be there probably half an hour to an hour before most of the other teachers.
So where we see Principal Goodman here and people questioning why he was so quick to go over to Christy's home, well, my thoughts are two things. One, Christy lived only about 10 minutes from the school.
Right.
So we're not talking about like this guy went way out of his way, first of all. Second of all, we're talking about a situation where it's very likely she was supposed to have been there at 8 a.m.
Right.
This guy waited an hour. It's not like he's sitting there at the front door. Like, what is that? Back to the Future, where the principal's like right by the front door waiting for Marty McFly to be 2 seconds late
I think that's Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Ferris, my bad. But you see what I'm saying? It's not like this guy is sitting there right by the front door looking at his watch and she's 2 minutes late. He hops in his car and drives over to her house.
Right. He doesn't look suspicious to me at all, but like you said, the person that finds the body, you have to look at
him. You got
to
look at him. You got to look at him. There were several teachers that had had a long working relationship with Principal Goodman, and they just said that's who he was. You know, he was not just our boss. He was like a part of the team. He was a friend. He was a colleague. He was somebody that would go to bat for the people that worked at his school. He considered it a community of people working together to educate these children.
Yeah, cheers to all the teachers. And my sister is a teacher, a lot of family members. For teachers, I mean, that's a job.
Cheers to the educators. There's other people involved.
Yeah. But, you know, it's I'm sickly, man. I'm not actually sick. I actually feel fine. I just sound like shit.
Well, I'll tell you what. Okay, so now we do know that there are reports of three possible suspects early on in this investigation.
Yeah.
Now, you and I both agree, Principal Goodman, whether he was considered to be one of those three or not, he doesn't look suspicious to you and I. Agreed.
Well, right. And think about his last name.
He's Goodman.
Goodman.
How could he have done it?
Not Principal Badman.
The individual, there is an individual that does look very suspicious. So this included of the three suspects, we do know that this included a man that investigators believed was behaving very strangely almost immediately after the murder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the day after Christie was killed, a 45-year-old man named Ken Lockoff showed up at Christie's school. Now, I'm unclear as to his reasoning for being at the school, meaning this. What I'm not sure of was, did he show up there looking for Christie or asking what had happened to her?
Right.
So regardless, we do know that he shows up at her work and he's asking about her. I don't know if he's asking for her or if he shows up saying, does anybody know what happened to Christie?
Right. Did they date or something?
Well, get this. So here's what's going
on. Check this out, mother.
He was briefed on what had happened to her the day before.
Right.
And shortly after being briefed, he left the school, but later he called the school twice that same day. Later, this man was observed at Christie's funeral. When investigators started looking through Christie's private life and digging through her past,
mm-hmm.
they discovered that this man was having an extramarital affair with Christie. So this Ken Lockoff was a significantly older married man that Christie Merrick was discreetly dating this guy.
Part-time lover.
Well, police round this guy up. They go and they get Ken and they bring him in and they talk to him. Now, police would later say that Ken fully cooperated with the police and their investigation into Christie's murder. This meaning he answered all of their questions. He passed two polygraph tests and he submitted his DNA, which later cleared Ken from their suspect list.
Well, but that's how you do it, right? I mean, he showed up because he cared about her. He showed up trying to get answers. Then when the police come knocking on his door, he's like, hey, full cooperation. I'll answer all your questions. Oh, lie detector. I'll take two. Give me two of those.
That's funny. I tell you what, though. Here's the thing. Just my humble opinion. I would avoid the lie detector at all costs.
Okay.
Even if I'm innocent.
I agree. Except for in this case. You know why? Because we have DNA.
That's right? True.
So I'd go, okay, I'm submitting you my DNA. Let's take the lie detector.
That makes sense.
Now, and also, you know how this works. When they give you the lie detector, they'll say, okay, we asked the colonel 12 questions. Three of them he was a little iffy on.
Right.
Right? So... But I think if there's DNA and you know that you didn't do this, submit the DNA, you know.
Well, that's the other thing, too. I don't want to play your games and do the monkey test. Here's my DNA and let's get this over with. Mm-hmm. And if there were no DNA, this is just my opinion, I would never take a polygraph test especially if I'm innocent. And the reason being is, as the suspect, you have nothing to gain because even if you, let's say you pass it, it's not admissible in the court of law.
Right.
So like, oh, I got an A++ on my polygraph test, but we can't tell anybody in court that.
Oh, well, right. I mean, if you look at the West Memphis 3 case, I mean, Jesse Miss Kelly passes a lie detector and then confesses to the murder.
Well, and what
and if the cops even believed in this idea of a polygraph, then you'd go, oh, well, here's this guy that clearly told us the truth. Now he's telling us a lie. He needs to stop telling us a lie. So I agree with you. There's nothing good that can come from
it. Right. You can only lose out of it.
Right.
And the other thing, too, especially in a situation like this where, like you said, he shows up on the scene caring about her, asking questions about her. I understand he's having an extramarital affair. That doesn't mean he's not in love with her. And furthermore, he cooperates in the investigation. That also shows, one, he's innocent, two, that he cared about her. And what I'm getting at here is referencing something that John Douglas educated me on through his books, was stating that sometimes, especially with a husband or a wife, uh-huh, when you question them about a child or a loved one, you know, their spouse or another loved one's death, there's a certain bit of survivor's guilt. There's also, especially with a husband, there's kind of this ingrained thing in our DNA where we're supposed to protect our families.
Right.
And when a family member dies,
and probably ingrained in,
well, ingrained the wife, in everybody.
Well, you know, for the children.
Going off of referencing Douglas's words, though,
right,
where he states that, you know, with a husband in particular, that you could get false positives, meaning false positives of guilt, signs of deception,
right.
during the test, because even though the husband had nothing to do with the death of his wife or the murder of his wife, he still feels guilty for not having protected her from what happened.
Right.
So this is one of those situations where I feel like it's just it's a lose, but congratulations to Ken for being forthcoming and helping out in the investigation. And like we've said many times, Captain, with a lot of these cases, when we look at things, it's hard to sit down and just solve something, especially, you know, for the police.
Maybe for you.
They can't just sit down and solve something. But if they can cross something off their list, if they can strike something from the list of possibilities, they can start to hone in on different things and angle the investigation, and maybe it leads you to the answer.
For everything True Crime Garage, check out truecrimegarage.com. Also, make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at True Crime Garage.
And we want to see you right back here in the garage for the conclusion of the Christy Merrick case. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.